Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That exuberant music is by Leonard Bernstein, and it is the overture to Candide. And this is one of a number of wonderful pieces that will comprise the program for the next Lakeside Pops concert of the Racine Symphony Orchestra, coming up on Friday, August 27th. And I'm really delighted to have with me on the phone Jonathan Winkle, Executive Director of the Racine Symphony, to talk about all of the musical treasures that are going to be offered up by the Racine Symphony for their next Lakeside Pops concert. And Jonathan Winkle, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Thank you very much, Greg. Glad to be here.
Glad we can have this conversation. We spoke a little earlier in the summer about the first Lakeside Pops concert, and I trust that everything went well that night?
It went very well. And, of course, we were trying out a new venue, Fountain Banquet Hall, due to our not being able to use Festival Hall for the time being.
Right. So at the moment, this series is not able to live up to its name of Lakeside Pops, but but in every other respect, it is exactly the kind of experience that that people can enjoy. So it's a really wonderful lineup of repertoire that is part of this concert, and also present that evening will be a musician who is very, very well known to many people here in southeastern Wisconsin, Jeff Ward. Tell our listeners what sort of theme ties everything together that night, the night of the 27th.
Essentially, the program is tied together through a series of either very direct Gaelic influences or somewhat indirect influences from those musical traditions, and so you'll definitely see a through line in Rob Tomorrow, our guest conductor's programming.
Was this something that he came up with, or that you came up with, or that you came up with in collaboration with one another?
This is something that Rob came up with prior to my being hired as executive director. So this was a series of decisions that came about I'm assuming sometime in the prior year, but I'm not sure exactly what the precise genesis was of the program.
Right. Well, it is very, very impressive. I think it's going to feature all kinds of things that will be entertaining and interesting for the audience. And a lot of things will be familiar favorites. I think probably the piece that will be maybe the least known, but which intrigues me very much, is a piece I've known and loved for a long time. It's a movement from the so-called Gaelic Symphony of Mrs. H.H.A. Beach, or Amy Beach. First of all, in your wide-ranging career as both an impresario and manager and performer, I suspect you've had scant experience with Amy Beach's Gaelic Symphony. It's just not done very much. Or am I wrong? Has it crossed your path before this?
You are correct, Greg. In fact, I've never played it as a trombone player, and it has great brass writing. So it's a fabulous symphony. And I think it has gained a little bit more traction in terms of being programmed more frequently in more recent years. But it's a piece, I think, that deserves to be played very regularly and should be a part of the standard repertoire. And hopefully that will become the case, because it's wonderful.
Right. Is there anything you want to say to our listeners about this intriguing composer, Amy Beach?
Well, Amy Beach was a woman from the Boston area, and she lived from essentially the back half of the 19th century to through the first half of the 20th century. And this particular work was very directly inspired by Dvorak, and he had spent a period of time, as many of the listeners may know, in the 1890s in the U.S. And so she composed this particular work. I believe it was completed in 1894, but then premiered by the Boston Symphony Orchestra in 1896 or thereabouts. And it was very well received. It did get performed with a fair amount of regularity in early years, and she was also a fabulous concert pianist, and I think she may have gotten a fair amount of performance traction for this work and other works of hers in Europe, in particular after her husband passed away in 1910, 1911 or so. And unfortunately, women were not supported in the ways that they should have been in these types of pursuits, and that included sometimes not programming fantastic works of art, and this is one of those. And it really comes out of that tradition of sort of this kind of just unapologetic, romantic, kind of nationalistic style of composition. In this case, she really relied heavily on her own sort of neighborhood, if you will, of Irish and other Gaelic-influenced cultures that were in the Boston area. And I just think it's a fantastic symphony, and I'm really glad that Rob has added this last movement to the program. It's a very exciting, rousing sort of 9 or 10 minutes of music, and I think the audience will love it.
Let's hear just the opening of this final movement of the symphony in E minor, known as the Gaelic Symphony by Amy Beach, or as she for some reason preferred to be known in printed concert programs, Mrs. H.H.A. Beach. And the recording we have here at the station is with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, Carl Krieger conducting, a recording made under the auspices of our own Library of Congress. Here's a little bit of Amy Beach's Gaelic Symphony.
Thank you.
Yeah, we do get a sense of some really opulent writing for the brass. And so, so you're going to be sitting in the audience consumed with envy, I have a feeling, wishing you were up on the stage with the trombone section.
That happens. It's true. If I'm not in the orchestra, sometimes you have that experience of, I wish I could be playing this right now.
No kidding. Very good. Another piece that is on the program for August 27th that I'm really excited about is a piece by Felix Mendelssohn, which is known by two different titles, something like Fingal's Cave or In Fingal's Cave, or otherwise known as the Hebrides Overture, and I think it's one of his masterworks. What would you like to say about the Hebrides Overture?
In keeping with this Gaelic theme, this piece was really a direct result of his trip to the British Isles, and specifically to Scotland and a particular island there. And there was a specific sea cave there known as Fingal's Cave. And I know in the process of composing this, I think. It's entitled the Hebrides Overture, or at some point in the revision in 1832, but I think in the score it says Fingal's Cave. So that's where you sometimes have these two names used interchangeably. And even though it's labeled an overture, it's not a prelude to another work. It's a standalone program piece. And I think it's a wonderful work. And of course, Mendelssohn is one of our great European composers, and I think this is another fantastic piece of music qualitatively, and then of course it has the really wonderful programmatic connection through this Gaelic themed concert.
Yeah, great choice. My own introduction to this music came in one of those famous Warner Brothers cartoons, except it wasn't Bugs Bunny or Roadrunner. It was a cartoon that featured a really wonderful character named Ralph Phillips, this little boy who was always lost in daydreams. And so through the wonders of animation, we'd be sort of taken away into these things he was daydreaming about. And one of the things he's daydreaming about as he's sitting in school is of being a deep sea diver and exploring the wonders of the deep ocean. And as he finds himself carried away into this daydream, the music that is used is the opening to the Mendelssohn Hebrides Overture, and that music just has this wonderful atmospheric quality that was just perfect for that moment, but it's perfect for any setting. Here's the way this opens. Again, this is the Hebrides Overture. I think Claudio Abbado happens to be the conductor of this particular recording. I just love Mendelssohn. I just think he's the best. And you know, he's one of those composers that for all of the really popular works he composed that are performed quite a lot, it seems to me that Mendelssohn is a composer that's not sufficiently appreciated, maybe because he wasn't a groundbreaking revolutionary, but boy, he knew how to write great music.
I completely agree with you, Greg. Yeah, his music is first rate, and I've never quite understood either why it's not performed more often than it is.
Speaking of other favorites, many, many people will be very, very familiar with a Percy Grainger work that is going to be part of this concert, namely Irish Tune from County Derry. Tell our listeners who may not recognize that particular title what music we're actually talking about here.
I think a lot of people probably will recognize this melodic material as Danny Boy. But if I'm not mistaken, I think Danny Boy was actually created in terms of those lyrics attached to this melody after Granger's setting. So I think this was from the melody was from a collection of folk music that he had run across, and he was Australian and found himself in the UK at a certain point and in the US. But I think that he set this to, I think, a wordless chorus first, if I'm not mistaken about that, which is an interesting choice. And that might have been around 1901 or 1902. And he continued to work with this material. I think he wrote it for two-hand piano part, or maybe four hands. Then, of course, he orchestrated it for orchestra. I first was introduced to this setting of this melodic material by Granger through his setting for band or wind ensemble. And so that's very commonly performed in the concert band world, but it's gorgeous.
Yeah, melodies don't get much more beautiful than this. Let's listen to a little bit of this. This is Frederick Fennell from an old Mercury compact disc with the Eastman Rochester Pops Orchestra, with Granger's setting of this beautiful melody, Irish tune from County Derry. I love the way Granger crafts this arrangement to enhance the beauty of this piece without, in a sense, getting in the way of its simple beauty. That's going to be something really, really special. And there are a couple of other pieces on the program as well. Do you just want to run those down briefly for us?
Well, I think some people will be familiar with Leonard Bernstein's Overture to Candide, and this, in fact, is an overture to a larger work. His operetta from the mid-1950s, but it's become, without question, the most performed work of Bernstein's for orchestra. You know, it's a relatively short piece, but it's highly virtuosic for the orchestra. It's very closely associated with the New York Philharmonic, not surprisingly, because of Bernstein's long association as music director and then in his emeritus status. And no, it's a real barn burner in terms of what you have to be able to do as a musician, and but I just love doing anything by Bernstein. I mean, he's one of the great sort of polymath musicians of the 20th century, and happened to be American, and this is just one of the many facets of his genius and his composition quality, and this is a great example of it. And of course, we've got, as you mentioned earlier, Greg, this wonderful musician, Jeff Ward, singer-songwriter, guitarist, he's been in the Milwaukee Racine area for a long time now, but he is from the UK originally, and so he has often drawn from Irish, Scottish, English, Welsh, all those various Celtic cultures. And so he's going to be doing some solo material. Rob Tomorrow, our guest conductor, has also orchestrated a few of the pieces for the Racine Symphony Orchestra and Jeff to perform. And I know that the two of them are going to do at least one piece with guitar, because Rob is a guitarist. And so it's going to be a really varied program, and I think it will be a very uplifting program and very enjoyable for people. And, you know, it's right in that whole, when you think about going to a Pops concert with a symphony orchestra, it's really about seeing your friends and family and really having a wonderful time and hearing some great music. Doesn't have to always be so very serious, right? Mm. It can just be joyful and light. And I think that's going to be very much the experience for people on the 27th.
Very good. Friday night, August 27th. Remind our listeners of the location of this concert and what people should do if they want to get tickets.
It's going to be at the Fountain Banquet Hall, and technically that's in Sturtevant. It's right on Highway 11, about 3.5 miles east of I-94. And you can call the office at 262-636-9285 and ask for Heather. Or you can purchase tickets online at racinesymphony.org.
Very good. And it promises to be a marvelous night of all kinds of magnificent music with the Racine Symphony, guest artist Jeff Ward, and guest conductor Dr. Rob Tamaro. And John Winkle, the man behind the scenes, making so much of this happen as executive director of the Racine Symphony. John Winkle, great to reconnect with you, and very best wishes to you and everybody associated with the Racine Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you so much, Greg.
And here are the final measures of the aforementioned Bernstein Overture to Candide. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about some of the facets of being a good leader. And the perspective that is shared in this book called The Everyday Leader comes from a husband and wife, Hema Crockett and Michael Crockett. Hema Crockett is someone who has earned great success and awards in the world of business as an entrepreneur and former HR executive. Michael Crockett served the U.S. military in the Marines for 23 years. And they are combining their respective life experiences and perspectives into this new book called The Everyday Leader, 14 Marine Corps Traits to Unlock Your Leadership DNA. It's a book that explores the way in which people can be the best, most effective leaders they can possibly be, folding their own gifts into some of the essential tasks that go into being a good, effective, selfless leader. And so we're going to be talking with them, first of all, about the experience of crafting this book together, and we'll talk our way through at least some of these central traits to being an effective leader. The book is published by Morgan James, again titled The Everyday Leader, 14 Marine Corps Traits to Unlock Your Leadership DNA. Hema Crockett and Michael Crockett, we welcome you both to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much, Greg, for having us and for talking to us about The Everyday Leader.
Glad we can have this conversation. Before we talk about the book, let's find out a little bit about how the two of you met each other and what sort of the secret was and remains in terms of your life partnership.
Yes. You know, it's the age-old love story, right? We met in a bar in downtown San Diego. And that was now nearly 18 years ago. And it was interesting. I mean, at the time that we met, it was, I think, one of the keys to our meeting and success has been Mike was in the military, right? And it was a different kind of getting to know you relationship. He deployed shortly after we met and went to Iraq shortly thereafter. And we stayed in touch, and the rest is history. We've been married now for about 13 years. And we thought, what better way to see how long the marriage can last than writing a book together during a pandemic?
No kidding. Hema, explain to our listeners the kind of work that you have done in the business sector.
Yeah, absolutely. So I spent the majority of my career as an HR executive, really doing all facets of HR in different kinds of businesses, mainly startups, biotech, tech, fintech startups, worked for a lot of large Fortune 50 companies as well, and was brought in during times of transformation, and whether that was new leaders that were coming in, or whether that was a culture change, an acquisition, anything like that. And in about 2018, I decided to branch off and start my own company, Gig Talent. And we're really just focused on the gig economy. And I have a wonderful business partner, Jamie Jacobs, who is, her and I have really built that company together. And it allowed us to bring Mike into that fold as well and use both his leadership experience and his military background.
Fantastic. Michael Crockett, explain what drew you to the Marine Corps. And I think it would be good to know, first of all, what drew you just to want to serve our country in the military, and then what led you specifically to choose the Marine Corps as the branch of the service to which you wanted to devote your time and energy and devotion?
That is a really good question. I think as a little kid, I used to watch a lot of police shows, and that protection, that service always resonated with me. And I think, I remember sitting in high school and there was a Marine recruiter that came in. I saw him in his dress blues and his demeanor and how he presented everything to the class and how he was very rigid, very strict. That also resonated with me, and I was hooked. I think I signed up when I was a junior in high school, and I stayed in the delay entry program just waiting to go to boot camp. And then once I was in, I was enthralled in the military culture. And my first unit was an infantry unit, and they are very strict and disciplined. And that really just, it resonated with me, and it really felt right. And the rest is kind of history. I mean, I just really enjoyed my time.
Well, and evidently because you remained with the Marines and had this successful career, and of course draw upon a lot of your life experiences and professional experiences for this new book, The Everyday Leader. Hema, maybe you could say a word about the collaboration of the two of you writing a book together. I think it might be the very first line of the book is, writing a book when you're married to the co-author is a test. I'm sure it is. First of all, what prompted the idea for this book to be written in the first place? And then tell us a little bit about what it was like to craft it together.
Yeah, absolutely. So really, the idea came early pandemic, as I mentioned. And this was March timeframe where nobody knew, right, how long we were going to be in our houses for. We didn't know what was going to happen. And with our business, we started noticing a lot of clients reaching out and asking about leadership coaching, asking about training for their managers, how they can become better leaders, especially in a remote environment. And it just really led Mike and I to talk about the difference in leadership, quite frankly, and how it shows up in the military and the business world. And through that, he started explaining to me these 14 Marine Corps leadership traits and how they're pretty much ingrained right in boot camp, and then further ingrained as you go on throughout your career. And I started thinking how different businesses would be and how different individuals would be if organizations had the same type of leadership traits and taught the same type of leadership traits from day one, and what difference that could make to the business in the long run as well. And that's really where the idea came from. You know, all of a sudden we were sitting there and thought, well, why don't we write that? You bring the military, I bring the business, and we can make this work. And that's literally how the book was written. In terms of writing it together, I would say that it was actually a pretty fun experience because it allowed Mike to bring out a lot of his military stories. And for any of the listeners, the way the book is structured is each chapter is a leadership trait, and it starts off with one of Mike's stories or one of his fellow Marines' stories demonstrating either that leadership trait or the lack thereof that leadership trait. And it allowed me to really see some of Mike's background, you know, long before we met, what boot camp was like and some of those things. But I'll tell you, a pandemic helped at the end of the day. It forced us to stay in the same house together, forced us to write together. And now it's the fun part, I think. Now it's fun speaking with everybody around the world about the book and just really getting those lessons out there.
For those of you who are just joining us, I'm speaking with Hema Crockett and Michael Crockett, who are co-authors of The Everyday Leader, 14 Marine Corps Traits to Unlock Your Leadership DNA. Michael Crockett, explain where these 14 leadership traits are, in a sense, listed, cataloged with the U.S. Marine Corps. That is, where does that fold into the Marine Corps experience? When does a Marine learn about them, and how are they folded into a typical member of the Marine Corps' experience?
So the leadership traits, well, first we have a doctrine. The Marine Corps has a doctrine that it has goes through each one of them. It's titled leadership, but that is really ingrained. As soon as you step at the recruit depot, where you begin basic training, that's when it really starts to be force fed to you. And whether it's the drill instructors, how they interact with you, they are always setting an example for you, and it just carries throughout your entire career. Every time, every interaction you have with a leader. Or if you are in that leadership position, that you're expected to have those leadership traits. You're expected to put those in motion.
They are an interesting list too. And I appreciate the fact that some of them are absolutely expected, like integrity, decisiveness, right, judgment, initiative, endurance, and so on. But then there's certain traits like tact, T-A-C-T, tact, and that I think will be a bit of surprise to some people, or bearing, or knowledge. So I really appreciate the fact that it is a wide-ranging list of traits. Hema Crockett, as the non-Marine of the two of you, are there any that stand out to you as particularly noteworthy or that were especially interesting to write about?
Yeah, I would say one that was just funny for me was enthusiasm, right? I found that to be a pretty funny leadership trait coming from anything military, to be honest. But the more that we talked about it, it kind of sparked some different thinking for me in the way that I would view it. But the ones that I really liked and I would say really enjoyed writing about were ones that I think are really important in business today. And those are things like courage, decisiveness, judgment as well. I think that especially during the height of the pandemic, we saw that these types of leadership traits were really needed, not only if you were a leader of people, but if you were any employee going through the pandemic, which literally was all of us. Writing about those types of traits and converting them to the business world was actually really interesting. I mean, we think of courage really easily, right, in the Marine Corps or in the military as a whole, but how does that show up in the business world? And for me, it was really digging deep to think about courage really shows up as doing the right thing and being able to stand up for yourself and your employees. So once I started to think about those traits in a business context, the writing actually came pretty naturally at that point.
Excellent. There are a couple of them that I want to spend a little bit of time talking about. First of all, I think it would be interesting to hear one of the most interesting stories that comes in the book, in the chapter on dependability, and that is a story that involves an earthquake. And boy, it's a really kind of graphic example of how much we literally depend on the competency of other people, and how sometimes that competency is really tested in a supremely challenging moment like an earthquake. Michael, do you want to share that story?
So we lived in Kathmandu. I was a senior Marine in charge of security and of all of the embassy employees and the building. And I had a team of six other Marines that worked for me and worked with me. And we in Kathmandu, there was an earthquake that was imminent. Every 75 years, almost like clockwork, there was a large earthquake
it was just going to happen.
It was just going to happen. So it was always on the mind of the embassy employees. So that was something that the Marines and we rehearsed relentlessly to make sure that we were prepared and that we knew exactly what had to happen to keep everybody safe, as well as keep the building intact and maintain all of our security and all that good stuff. So when the earthquake happened, Emma and I, we were just putting away all of our groceries and we were downstairs and our sensors started to go off, the earthquake sensors, and it's a loud, loud ringing noise. we started to hear the rattle of the windows and then the glass breaking. And so we just hunkered down until the shaking stopped. And then we ran to the embassy, which is about 90 seconds away. And then once we got in there, it was like the Marines were already doing exactly what they were supposed to be doing. Like I didn't have to say anything to them. And what blew me away was how Hema just transitioned right in. And she just picked up, she filled in the gaps that we needed to fill at that time. Which allowed me to go and check on all the Marines and just to keep my peace of mind.
Yeah, and in a place like Kathmandu, communication is already hit or miss, let's put it that way. And so during an earthquake, communication was even more so critical. And one of the things that Mike and his team had done, and he didn't speak to this just now, but I actually appreciated this, is every weekend we would do something called radio checks. And they made it fun, quite frankly. Everybody at the embassy had a different name, a different call sign. And the Marines would call out every single call sign and you had to do a radio check back. So they made sure that all of the embassy employees were also very well trained in how to call back and what that procedure was. But you know how these things go, Greg. The second something happens, sometimes that training goes out the window very easily, right? People scatter, people get scared. And I'll have to say that as an outsider really watching these Marines, because my job wasn't anything to do with the Marine Corps when I was at the embassy, this was the first time seeing them in action and to watch them just go directly into what they had trained for was absolutely amazing to see.
I love that story, and I love that whole chapter. Another chapter that I want to spend a little bit of time... actually, let's circle back to that for a second. Dependability. A little later in the chapter, after you've kind of spelled out some of the essential elements of dependability, there are some sort of additional suggestions that are shared that I really appreciate about in a sense, building one's sense of dependability. And it's things like learning how to say no or not making excuses. And I think those are the kind of things that we don't immediately think of as being essential to being dependable. And yet, when it comes to living this out in your day-to-day life, that's just as important as anything can be.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is why for us, these sections of putting it into practice in the book were so important, right? Because it's all these leadership traits sound great, but how do you bring them to life and what you're doing day to day? And so things like learning to say no, we still struggle with that. It's hard not to struggle with that, but it's a part of this process and it's a part of showing up as a leader, regardless again of what your role, title, or level is within an organization.
Right, exactly. Those of us who have a sort of a congenital difficulty with saying no, a lot of times that's when we end up stretching ourselves too thin or taking things on that are maybe beyond our capability. And the next thing you know, you're letting people down and yourself down. So yeah, I appreciated your conversation or discussion about dependability very much. In a couple of chapters later, you explore decisiveness and spell out that decisiveness is not just about making a decision, it's about making the best decision with the information that is available. So I think that's a really, it's a much more nuanced understanding of decisiveness than we sometimes have, where we picture kind of the bullheaded person who just makes decisions left and right very quickly and seemingly with ease. Interestingly, in this chapter, one of the things you spend some time talking about is taking extra time in order to be decisive. Just say a word about why you think that is a crucial element.
Yeah, I think the one distinction that you just pointed out too is part of that, right? It's making the best decision, not necessarily the right decision. So you make the best decision with the information you have available. And sometimes it is about just taking even 5 or 10 minutes, just that step back to look at the information that you do have and that you do know and coming to a conclusion in order to make a decision. You can always change it in the future. You can always adapt it as more information comes about. But I think in our everyday lives, it's really easy for us to quickly answer a question or quickly jump to a decision. And then that's where you backpedal a little bit a few minutes later and think, I shouldn't have done that, right? We just talked about saying no. Instead of saying yes immediately, if we just took a couple of moments to really think about, is that what I want to do? Am I good at doing X? Had we just allowed ourselves that those couple of minutes, we probably would have said, you know what, I appreciate it, but no, right? And so that's really what taking a few moments is about in that. And we say a couple of moments, quite frankly, because not everybody has the luxury of taking an hour, a day, a week, or a month to make a decision. Sometimes 5 minutes is really all we get, and that's all we need.
I like that. Could you also say a word about a very interesting turn of phrase in that same chapter, in which you talk about building the decisiveness muscle?
Yeah, I laugh at this one because I think we call out Mike in this chapter a little bit about Mike not being one of these people who can make quick decisions. And I think what it is with the decisiveness muscle, it's about confidence, right? And it's about really that self-assurance that you have the ability to make a decision. And that doesn't just happen overnight. That doesn't just come naturally to many people. I mean, we talk about the book in terms of unlocking your leadership DNA. We have it in us, but it's about how do you exercise that muscle? And I'll say, and I'll let Mike here speak in a second, but Mike's gotten much better at this over time because his confidence and his experience have allowed him to really tap into that decisiveness muscle. Want to add anything?
I mean, I will say that even in that chapter, I illustrate some bad decision making, some really bad, and the impact it had, especially as a leader. And then at the flip side, there was the other story I have in there is where I did take my time and I did make the right decision, where I'm choosing the right person for the position. And I mean, both could have had one on one hand, I had kind of dire consequences that, that negatively impacted the my entire unit. Whereas, and then conversely, when I did take my time, the, on the flip side, it did have a very positive effect on my unit because I did choose the right person.
Yeah. And it just takes time, right? Much like when you talk about exercising and building muscle, honestly, it just takes time. And it takes, I think, the more that we see and we experience in our lives and in our careers, we just build that confidence to do it.
Mike, I'm curious, of these 14 traits, we've already touched on at least one in which you had some room to grow and have grown over the years. Would you say there, could you choose one of these 14 traits that you feel like it has come very naturally to you? It's been very much central to who you are, maybe even before you ever be put on a Marine Corps uniform.
I would have to say it's courage. It's a matter of, even when I was a younger kid, I wasn't afraid to do certain things. Like I wasn't afraid to necessarily put myself out there in different environments. And as a Marine, I definitely stood up for what I believed in, and I stood up for my Marines. And a lot of times, that does take a lot of courage to stand in the fire and defend your Marines when you know they're right to their boss or to your boss, or have that difficult conversation with your boss. I mean, that is something that I feel that was a defining character trait for me during my time.
Very good. So, Hema Crockett, who do you think would most benefit from reading this book? What is the, who were you and Michael thinking of primarily when you wrote it?
Yeah, you know, I think we started out pretty broad, right? And as the title suggests, the everyday leader, it's really meant to be for any individual who wants to define or refine how they show up as a leader. But if we're really drilling down and getting much more specific, I would say it's ideal for employees looking to step into more of a leadership role, whether that is directly managing others, whether that is just really leading a team, perhaps their own team within a broader context. Organizations looking to take their leadership to the next level and really stand out above others in their field.
Well, I have enjoyed very much exploring this book, and I can think of a whole lot of ways in which it might really be useful. And in particular, in terms of broadening our notion of what it means to be a good leader. And one set of words I especially love towards the very end of the book was when you talk about how it's easy to identify a selfish leader. And of course, part of what all these traits are about are helping people understand what unselfish leadership is all about. And so there's a lot to be gleaned from this. The book again is The Everyday Leader, 14 Marine Corps Traits to Unlock Your Leadership DNA, published by Morgan James and the co-authors Hema and Michael Crockett. It was a pleasure speaking with you, and I'm glad that you gave the world this really interesting book. Thank you, and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg, for having us. Take care.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation with John Seeger, who is president and CEO of a nonprofit, nonpartisan group called Population Connection, which works to help encourage population stabilization both here and around the world. On Thursday, it's Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program, and with her will be Deanna Nicky, who is a restoration ecologist, and we'll be finding out about the work that they have done all around the state of Wisconsin. On Friday, two interviews about baseball, including one with a former major league